It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hey, Mariners Pod, welcome back. Thanks for being here once again. As on today's Mariners Pod, you know, it has been a really tough year when you think about the Hall of Famers we've lost, and the list is long. I mean, Whitey Ford, Bob Gibson, Lou Brock, Tom Seaver, Al Kaline, Joe Morgan. So I was thinking about just that list of guys, and I guess I started to think about it too when we were talking about Dave Niehaus, his passing 10 years ago, a couple weeks ago, and I was thinking about all those Hall of Famers we've lost, and I was thinking about how many of those Hall of Famers we've run across over the years, and you know, a couple of them, it's amazing, and it's something I never take for granted. You know, you grow up a baseball fan, and you know, Al Kaline is a great example. You hear all the stories about Al Kaline, how great he was, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm sitting in the booth in Detroit just getting ready for the game one day, and who rolls in but Al Kaline? And then you're hearing Al Kaline stories from Al Kaline himself. I mean, he's sitting right there. I think I've told this story too, one of my favorite. I was in the booth at home in Seattle at T-Mobile Park, and Lou Brock was there, and he was going to join us for an inning, and he was there promoting something. And my dad's from St. Louis, so I always knew all about Lou Brock and Bob Gibson and those great Cardinal players through the years. And I was like, wow, Lou Brock, this is so great. And it also happened to be a night at the ballpark that we were celebrating the Sonics. So there were a lot of former Sonics around. I mean, downtown, Freddie Brown and Jack Sikma and Gary Payton was there. And it just so happens, you know, we're in the booth, the game's going on. And, you know, if you can picture the booth, there's a front row where now Rick and Aaron and I kind of sit. And then there's a back row that's kind of elevated. And that's usually where Shannon Dreher sits. And there's a couple open seats up above us. And so I was sitting there for the ball game. This is a number of years ago now. And Gary Payton happened to roll in while Lou Brock was about to go on air with us. So, you know, I am sitting there in the top row and Lou Brock is next to me. Gary Payton is next to me. You know, I was a huge Sonics fan growing up. So the fact that Gary Payton there was amazing. And it was just Lou Brock and Gary Payton just carrying on this long conversation, which is just something I will never forget. And Gary Payton being Gary Payton, just animated. It was so great. So, so fun. So I thought about some of these conversations. Unfortunately, we had a number of these Hall of Famers on air with us. So I thought we'd revisit some of these conversations. And one of them is Lou Brock. He did go on air with us. And it's really interesting. I guess I'll get more in depth with it as before I play it for you, because the half inning he was on with us was interesting in a number of ways. So I'll talk about that. Also, Jared Oppoto has a great Tom Seaver story. We never had Tom Seaver on the air with us, but Jared Oppoto has a great story that I'll play for you. Just a couple of years ago, we had Joe Morgan on. He came on with us when we were in Houston. We happened to be there when the Astros had their initial Hall of Fame class, and Joe Morgan was part of that, so he came on air with us, so that will come up. And also, a really nice conversation with Aaron Goldsmith and Al Kaline. And Al Kaline talks about facing Bob Gibson in the conversation as well. So that we'll do that in a few minutes. So this is, I think, a fun one to revisit some of our great conversations through the years. And I guess, why don't we start with the Lou Brock? And what's interesting about this is, so just so you know, he was on with us during an inning. And I cut out, I edited, otherwise, because the inning lasted forever. It happened to be the last start for Eric Bedard in a Mariners uniform. And it was an 8-run inning that was put up against him. He got bounced in it. So the conversation with Lou Brock is happening while this inning is going on. So he's on the air forever. But I essentially sliced it down. You will hear some of the action, but I sliced it down to just the conversation with Lou Brock. Still, it's like 15 minutes long, and that's with cutting most of the action out. But it's kind of funny how stuff works. So that's the first conversation, is with the great Hall of Famer, Rick Riz, and Dave Valley with them on this broadcast with the great Lou Brock.
I have a very special guest up here in the booth, one of the greatest outfielders in the history of the game with the St. Louis Cardinals for many, many years. Lou Brock is with us. He's in the Hall of Fame. And, man, I had a chance to watch Lou play for many, many years growing up in Chicago. Here's the windup, and the 0-1 pitch swung on. Ground ball tore the hole at short and threw for a base hit. So Kochman gets aboard. And one of the worst trades in the history of the game of baseball, the Chicago Cubs. You were with the Cubs for about 3 years, 1964. You get traded away to the St. Louis Cardinals for Ernie Broglio, Lou. And the folks in Chicago are still reeling from that trade. What did you think about the deal at the time?
Well, it's funny you were mentioning that the trade deadline coming up probably this weekend.
Yeah.
When it happened, I get a lot of talk about that. One of the guys who covered that trade was a rookie writer, never had written a story before, and it turned out to be Brent Musburger.
Oh, yeah.
And that trade, ever since then, has been sort of in baseball history as a lopsided trade.
It was lopsided because you went on and had a Hall of Fame career. Here's Kelly Shopik, and he takes a strike from Bedard 0-1.
Well, it's not the fact that Ernie Broglio wasn't a good pitcher. I mean, he had won 60 games, so therefore, I didn't feel too bad when I got traded for value.
And the next pitch is Shopik, low and inside for ball 1-1-1, visiting with the great Lou Brock. And Lou, what brings you to Seattle at this time?
Well, I'm a spokesperson for a diabetes awareness program around the country. Tonight is diabetes awareness here at the ballpark. I came out just to support the American Diabetes Association, and therefore I got a chance to come see the game and talk to you and to enjoy the beautiful sunshine here in Seattle.
Well, it's finally here with us, Lou, because it wasn't this way a few weeks ago, but now we have some beautiful weather. Swinging a foul back by Shopik, and the count 1-2. So best of luck with the Diabetes Association. Visiting with the Hall of Famer Lou Brock. Lou, what was your best moment in the game of baseball? You had so many great games of the game with the Cardinals.
Actually, 3,000 hit. You know, once in a while, you get to be known as a runner. I stole a lot of bases, and people forgot about the fact you had a bat. The 3,000 hit was the crown of my career, and all the rest of those things seem to be stars ever in that crown.
Here's the pitch, and a swing and a miss by Shopik for strike three. So Bedard with a second strikeout, and there's one away. Visiting with the great Lou Brock. Lou with 938 career stolen bases. He had 118 steals in 1974 when he established the single-season mark at that time. Here's the pitch on the way, and it's outside for ball 1-1-1. And what do you remember about that night when you broke the record?
Well, it was quite a few people in the stand, and what I remember most is that the pitcher on the mound for Philadelphia were more nervous than I was.
You made a lot of pitchers nervous.
Yeah, he was a little shaky out there, and I thought this is a good chance, time to do all of these things. Yeah. But it was a big night, and I was 35 years old at the time. They equate that to a 10-year-old horse running in the Kentucky Derby. So that's what I mostly remember about it. It was a task, and it got done.
Well, I was a 19-year-old kid, and I happened to be at that ball game. Drove up from Southern Illinois University to watch that game. That's the night you set the record. Here's the pitch, low and outside, ball 2-2-2. And 10 years later, you were nice enough to sign that ticket. I kept that ticket with me for 10 years. And I met you at the Adams Mark Hotel in Kansas City, and you signed that ticket for me, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking. Thank you for keeping up with it. That's a hard thing to do for 10 years to hold on to a ticket.
Oh, well, that was my good luck
he
piece.
He kept it in his wallet.
He kept it.
Yeah, it never left his person.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And you signed it for me, so thank you very much. Besides being blessed with tremendous speed, obviously, some great base stealers in the history of the game. There was Maury Wills and And you, here's a pitch on the way, and it's high for ball three, 3-2. Then Ricky Henderson came along. What made you such a great base stealer?
Number one is the Cardinals actually wanted to use the stolen base as a weapon. The meeting was called, and there was Craig Flood, McCarver, and I, Bob Uecker. And when the manager said we would have a base stealer, neither one of us were base stealers, so Uecker volunteered. And the manager said, Brock, you're the guy. So I had to go out and learn how to steal bases.
And then who? Uecker. You brought up Bob Uecker's
Bob
name.
Bob Uecker, yeah.
Bob could run?
Well, he thought he could.
That's amazing you mentioned his name.
Well, only because he volunteered in that meeting to be the guy.
Really?
Actually,
I can see you doing that.
But how could you could do it? He was never on base. At least Lou was on base.
He didn't play that much.
Well, he knew that none of us was able to run base as well as Mario Wills, so he might as well be the guy.
Here's the 3-2 pitch to Matt Joyce on the way. Swung on, popped up, foul, and out of play. Still 3-2, visiting with Lou Brock. So the Cardinals went to you and said, listen, we're going to steal some bases. And you and Kurt Flood did.
Well, they thought that to be competitive against the Dodgers, you had to steal bases. Bob Gibson could match Koufax pitch to pitch. Ken Boyer could hit as well as Tommy Davis.
Oh, yeah.
But nobody could run and match Mario Wills, who actually got on the base, and he just dominated the game.
Yeah.
The Cardinals wanted to do that, too, so I was the chosen person for that.
Well, they chose the right guy. Here's a swing and a pop-up behind home plate and out of play, heading for Mr. Brock. And the count is still 3-2. Lou, are we ever going to see another guy steal 100 bases?
I think you will. The real base stealer is not in the game today. I don't see anybody out here with world-class speed. So when that runner shows up, he will steal bases because he's going to be big and he's going to be dominating. And running going to be part of what he does. So that world-class speed runner is not in the game anymore. He's in football, but he's a D-back.
Yeah.
And today he's basically walking the street.
Love to see another Lou Brock somewhere. Here's the set by Bedard. And again, the 3-2 on the way to Matt Joyce. Curveball, and it misses outside for ball four. So Joyce with a walk. Kochman is pushed down to second base. There's one out, no score. Bedard in another jam. No score, top of the second, visiting with Mr. Lou Brock.
You know, Lou, you brought up a great point. You were talking about how so many people look at your career and they think of you as speed in the stolen base, but you did have over 3,000 hits. But when you look at base stealers today, you can't steal first base.
Right.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And you worked, you used a bat. You were an offensive player who learned how to steal.
So absolutely. And that's what I was talking about. The manager came to me and said, you're going to steal bases. And I just thought he was off his rocker. After all, I was getting about 200 hits a year. And
is that all?
That was all.
He wanted you on second base after you got that hit.
Yeah, but get on the base and dominate the base and take over the game. That was not part of what I did, but didn't take long before I was able to do it. Took about a year and a half, and then I began to love it.
Here's Sean Rodriguez, and first pitch a strike. The next offer is a curve down and in for ball one. One ball and one strike on Rodriguez.
For you, what was easier to steal, second base or third?
Well, I had some hitters behind me who you dare not try to steal third when they was up there. They were RBI guys. So during my era, basically it was getting in scoring position,
right,
which was second base.
Okay.
That
makes sense.
Pitch. Swing and a miss by Rodriguez, and the count goes to 1-2. But in your career, you hit .293.
Actually, I wanted to hit more than that, but somehow those pitchers was a little tough out there.
They were trying to, weren't they?
Yeah, they were trying to. After all, you know, one out of three is tough to do.
You're not kidding.
And you know what I enjoy hearing? The broadcaster saying this guy is a ground ball pitcher. Hit the ball on the ground. Most ground ball, one out of three is a hit. And when you bat in .333, you go to the Hall of Fame.
That's right.
So you can make a Hall of Fame player about hitting one out of three, hitting ground balls. And that's the neat part of baseball.
Well, with great speed like you yourself, we've seen Ichiro do that over the last decade. Hit balls on the ground and come out with 200 hits a year.
Next pitch on the way is outside on Rodriguez, 2-2.
Well, his style of hitting, he come close to Raf Garr type hitting than anybody else. Raf Garr was one of those guys who leave home plate. You would think that he's out of the batter's box.
Yeah.
But yet he was still there, but he was on the move. Ichiro does it with the best of him.
Now, Lou, you played in an era when I was growing up, when I fell in love with the game of baseball. Who are your three toughest pitchers and the three greatest players that you saw or played with?
Willie Mays may have been the greatest I ever saw. And I was in the National League, so I didn't see a lot of Mickey Mantle. But I don't think anybody could outplay Willie Mays and the guy called Hank Aaron.
Oh, my.
In terms of pitching, they had Sandy Koufax. Certainly, as a hitter.
And you were left-handed.
Yeah, you want to get a good swing at a pitch. And Sandy, you did that, but you couldn't hit it. But there was another pitcher named Bob Veal, may have been the toughest I've ever seen. He was big, Randy Johnson's type pitcher, and I never got a good swing at him. And I must have struck out 18, 19 consecutive times against him. And I was
you weren't the only one, buddy. Visiting with Lou Brock. Lou, you had that tremendous career in the big leagues for a long time with the Cubs and the St. Louis Cardinals. And then at the end, after you retired, resigned to the Hall of Fame, here is the set. And the 2-1 pitch on the way swung on, fouled out of play, and the count is even at 2 balls and 2 strikes. What was it like standing up there in Cooperstown?
You know, people ask that question quite often. I always say that now you have been voted in, your nominee, you're standing there, all of the Hall of Famers around you. All you know is that you have a seat among those guys. And basically, you just want to say, do not bother my seat until I make this speech. Because
here's the pitch, swung on, ground ball to short, taken, bobbled by Ryan. He's got it. The throw to first, and it's in time to get Longoria on the play. Jennings will score from third, and the Rays now have a 4-0 lead, and there's two outs in the inning. So give Longoria a run batted in. But that had to be a tremendous moment for you.
It's a tremendous moment, inasmuch you know that somewhere around 17,000 men play the game. That's only about 200 have made the Hall of Fame, and you've been one of them. And you feel fortunate to have been selected. It's not something that you can look at and say, I want to do these things. You got to be selected.
Well, congratulations, buddy.
You know, funny you asked that question. This past weekend was a Hall of Fame induction.
Yes.
And about 45 guys came back to watch Bly Levin.
Robbie Alomar, Pat Gillick.
They did tremendous well at the microphone. They were nervous. And I thought, Bill Mazeroski was the epitome of going into the hall. He had waited so long. He stood up there about 5 seconds.
Cried.
Couldn't go any further, and that was it.
That was it. He was done. He sat down. Cried and sat down.
Right.
Some people say it was the greatest speech of all time.
We think it was.
It was short for you
guys.
It
was short, but the fact emotional, it was.
Yeah.
It went off the Richter scale.
Yeah. Dave Niehaus talked about that. He's close friends with was close friends with Bill. When you first came up with the Cubs, what was it like playing with Ernie Banks?
It was a joy. Ernie was the kind of player, and still is the kind of man that talks to everybody. He just talked. And it made you feel comfortable. He knew everything about you. You walk into the big league, he'd tell you your name, what your college coach name was.
Uh-huh.
You go, wow, really? This is big league baseball. That's Ernie Banks. He was the only person who could ever do that.
One of the greatest ambassadors of all time.
Actually, Ernie used to drill me every night as to, could you hit Sandy Koufax? Can you hit Drysdale? I could not go to sleep. I had to answer these questions.
Really?
Yeah.
Say, Ernie, how did you do against Sandy?
Well, he always had a theory. He said, this guy just had 2 fingers on the ball. The other one got 3 fingers on the ball. You got to release it. And you can hit it. You can do it. He was a great encourager.
Lou, were you signed by Buck O'Neill?
Yeah, I was scouted by Buck O'Neill and Southern University of Baton Rouge. And Buck O'Neill signed myself, Ernie Banks, George Altman.
Wow.
Yeah, he was pretty good. Had a pretty good eye for talent.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
How come he's not in the Hall of Fame? Here's the pitch down and away on Kochman for ball one. There's a special Buck O'Neill Achievement Award. But I'd love to see him in the Hall of Fame for what he did in the Negro Leagues with Kansas City, bringing you guys to the big leagues.
I doubt if he ever get in. He had that last shot at it about 3 years ago, and that was it. But the fact is that the Hall of Fame have gone so far to create a Buck O'Neill Award, so yeah, his name be immortalized in the history of baseball.
Lou, I loved it when we'd go to Kansas City and Buck was there. He still had that bounce in his step and that smile on his face, that energy, that life, that passion for the game and the people who played it, and telling the stories about cool Papa Bell. Oh, man, and Satchel Paige, his roommate.
Speaking of Buck O'Neill, you know, they tried 1 year to make him the oldest player to go to bat in the minor leagues.
In the minor leagues?
Yeah, he was in his 90s. So he got into the game. They said, do not swing at the ball.
Uh-huh.
And they threw a pitch rather close. Buck swung at it.
No way.
When they asked him what happened, he said, they got it a little close.
At 90 years of age.
Yes, he took a big whack at it.
I knew about Minnie Minoso playing in, what, 5 decades?
Right.
Wow, Buck O'Neill. Gosh.
So his name is in the history book.
Sure miss him.
Well, they play a different brand of ball today. During my era, I hate to say it, two or three batters would be on their back by now.
They don't pitch inside anymore, Lou.
No, that's why.
Here's the pitch on the way, swinging a foul out of play on the third base side.
Well, that's a great point. The other thing is that is so amazing to me, to see the number of hits that you had in the pitching era. I mean, you were playing in an era, as you mentioned, you get two hits, the next time up, they're throwing one to knock you down, to try to intimidate you.
Well, Gaylord Perry, for an example, I had three hits off of him in a row, came up the fourth time. He's looking at me, and every time he started to wind up, I would back out of the box. And eventually he yelled, I don't want to hit you. I said, oh, okay, so I'll bat now. But you knew it was coming. No, he didn't. He kept his word.
Gaylord was here in Seattle back in 1982 and 83, won his 300th game here in 1982 as a Mariner.
But he was terrific. He was terrific. And he could get into a hitter's head in a hurry. All he had to do was put his hand to his mouth and do all those things and throw you perhaps one of the wicked fastball you ever saw.
Super sinker. Here's the pitch, 2-2. Swing and a miss for strike three. Joyce goes down swinging, and that will finally end the inning. But the Rays bat around for 8 runs. Here in the top half of the second. Lou Brock, thank you so much for coming by tonight. It was a joy.
Well, thank you all for having us, and we're a pleasure to have been presented here as the American Diabetes Association.
Lou, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
This is a really great story. If you're a Wheelhouse listener, you know that Jerry DePoto, Tom Seaver was his hero, and I love this story about Jerry DePoto's first interaction with the great Tom Seaver.
On Tom Seaver, I will tell you this, as I may have mentioned before, my favorite player growing up, and Sandy did not deliver me a Tom Seaver autograph, but when I was a rookie, I was playing for the Cleveland Indians, and this was back when ESPN or ABC, there was a game, it was before kind of the regional sports networks, and there was a game on TV almost every night where, you know, you had ESPN Monday night, Thursday night, Friday night baseball, etc. So in addition to your local cable network, you would get these one-offs on national TV. And, you know, I was with the Cleveland Indians right as we were rebuilding or ascending toward that World Series team in 95. And we were just leaving New York. And I'm looking at across the field. Tom Seaver was then an announcer, you know, the color guy for WPIX, the Yankees cable channel. And I was just kind of staring at him from across the field. And one of my teammates said, just go ask him for an autograph. I said, I can't ask him for an autograph. It's Tom Seaver. I'm not going to go talk to him. And, you know, he won't bite type thing. So I went and spoke with him and leaned on the cage. And it's the first time I met him. And he's since become, you know, he's a baseball hero of mine, but I leaned on the cage and I said, Tom, it is a pleasure to meet you. I am your biggest fan. And he turned around, he said, I've never heard that before, you know, and jokingly smiled at me. And we talked for a brief period. And then we got back to Cleveland the next day on a getaway day. That night or that day in in New York, Jim Abbott threw a no-hitter against us. So apparently it wasn't great luck that Tom Seaver and I had our first chat. But we made our way back to Cleveland, and the clubhouse guy came and presented me with a brown paper bag. And he said, hey, Tom Seaver, you know, we were getting ready for an evening game on ESPN. And he said, Tom Seaver passed this along, wanted you to have it. And I opened up the bag, and it was a baseball sign, you know, to Jerry from your number one fan, Tom Seaver. And that still holds a very prominent position on my desk. So you brought a good memory back.
Oh my gosh, that is a fantastic story. Do you remember what you were like when you opened that up? I mean, that must have been an utter shock for you.
Oh, it was like a kid in a candy store, truly. And it's of the many things that I've collected through the course of my time in the game. I think I may have mentioned this. Like my brother, who is my brother's a psychologist in suburban Kansas City, big Tom Seaver fan himself growing up, and he's asked me about my biggest thrills. Like, what were your biggest thrills? And that is one of them. The first time I met Tom Seaver, the first time I met Nolan Ryan, just the first time I faced George Brett. You get that you get to do the things that you dreamed about doing when you were a kid, and it's phenomenal to kind of live the life of Riley, where you realize all your dreams, and it's awesome.
So we were in Houston a couple of years ago, and Joe Morgan was being inducted along with many others into the initial Hall of Fame class for the Houston Astros, and he joined us for a half inning on the air.
Joe, who did you pay it forward? Nelly Fox, you know, got you going when you became an established player. Who did you pay it forward to? What guys did you take under your wing?
Well, I think when it was actually all turned out to be.
Pitch to Altuve, popped up, foul on the first base side, and it's going to be out of play, and it's 0-2.
It was actually most of the guys in Cincinnati. They brought up a lot of young guys, Griffey, Concepcion, and those kind of guys. And I just kind of passed along what they taught me. And make no mistake about it, I've said this 100 times, that everybody should be blessed to play one season with Pete Rose.
I'll bet.
I know Pete has done a lot of things, and I'm his biggest critic for doing things, but I tell you what, I lockered next to Pete Rose for 8 years.
You played with him in Philly, too, right?
Yep, and played with him one more year in Philly. But let me tell you something. Like I said, everybody should be blessed to play 1 year. You don't have to play two or three or whatever, and I got to play nine.
So what's the biggest takeaway?
Just the way he came every day.
Right.
Pete Rose, I don't care what it is, every game was like the seventh game of the World Series. Yeah. He's the only guy I've ever seen that could do that.
Mm.
I mean, every day was like the seventh game of the World Series. I never, you know, not anybody else that I've ever seen could do that.
Man.
Yeah, so you come in sometimes, man, I'm feeling a little down. I look over at Pete. He said, man, let's go. You know, I mean, that's the way it is. I like to think that I helped him to understand a little bit more about what winning was about. He didn't ever walk before. After I got there, he got 100 walks. You know, he got on base more. We helped each other, you know, and I say it all the time. I was just fortunate. Sparky knew what he was doing when he lockered me next to Pete.
Nice. Yeah, Sparky was
a
smart man.
Sparky was very smart.
Visiting with a
two-time. And he'll never get the credit he deserves for being the chief of that Big Red Machine.
Oh, man, guys were good, too.
Yeah, I love Sparky.
Well, we were good, but Sparky knew how to handle everybody.
Swing and a fly ball deep into right field. Smith going back, and this one is gone. Goodbye, baseball. Little Jose Altuve with an opposite field home run to straightaway right. Astros now lead it by a score of 4-0 here in the bottom of the fifth. Joe, does he remind you of anybody?
No.
No.
He's amazing. I mean, just what he just did, hitting the ball to the opposite field, hitting a home run. Don't see little 5-foot guys hitting the ball the other way for a home run.
He's got ridiculous power.
He does.
And Altuve, that's his 11th career home run against the Mariners. Fourth this year.
18th home run of the season, 4-0 Houston. Yeah, he was hurt early in
Long
the year.
Time. Yeah.
Made up a lot of time.
Man, he is special.
Here is Michael Brantley visiting with the Hall of Famer Joe Morgan, honored by the Astros tonight, 16 into the Houston Astros Hall of Fame. First induction class, hard to believe, but it finally happens here in 2019. What was it like seeing all those guys down there, Nolan Ryan, Mike Scott, the broadcasters that go in, Bob Elson, Milo Hamilton, and all the other guys? That had to bring back some great memories.
Well, you know what? It showed me the memory. First thing I saw, they showed Mike Scott up on the thing throwing and how that ball was disappearing.
Oh, yeah.
I said, how did anybody ever hit that? Well, they didn't often, yeah. But, no, you're right. All those guys, Gene Elston, all those guys were here when I first broke in. You know, Gene Elston was. Milo came later. But Gene Elston was here.
Here's a swing and a fly ball into shallow left. Coming up is Ryan Court. Court is there to make the catch, and there's one away as Brantley flies out, visiting with Joe Morgan.
Yeah, it was interesting because Bob Astromonte was one of the original Colt 45. He was at one end, and I'm kind of at the other. And they filled in between, as they say. but, no, it was really exciting and be out there on the field today with those guys. And, you know, like I said, I have to tell you the truth. Jimmy Wynn was my roommate all those years I was here.
Oh, the toy cannon.
And Jimmy's, you know, struggling now.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
And then when I looked up there on the board to see who he was and what he was, I have to tell you, I my eyes just watered up because I was his roommate when he'd be doing all those things, man, and we just celebrate together and whatever. And
good player.
It's just a great player. Like man. I said, Jimmy Wynn. I'm going to tell you again, Jimmy Wynn, Cedeno, and Griffey Jr.
There's a shot fair down the left field line. Off the seats and angle out by Bregman. Bregman will hold at first base after the turn as the ball bounces out. And the shortstop, J.P. Crawford, able to go out there and get it as the ball ricochets off those seats. So Alex Bregman is on at first base with one out here in the bottom of the fifth.
Quick question about Jimmy Wynn. Some of the video they had, they showed him with the toothpick. Did he play with the toothpick?
Yeah, of course.
Did.
Yeah.
So he, UL Washington BF4. Got that from him,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, he had it in there. Jimmy did it all the time.
Oh, my goodness.
And people don't know about Jimmy. He had he swung a 36-inch, 36-ounce bat.
Oh, my goodness. And a little guy.
He's the only guy that could hit the ball out of the Astrodome consistently.
Man.
He was amazing.
Wanted to ask
That's
you.
That's why I keep telling you how amazing he was and the ability that he had. You know, so
a lot of home runs.
Yeah, I looked at those films and I felt remorse because I knew that he should have been a better player. Jimmy Wynn should be in the Hall of Fame. Cesar Cedeno, to me, should have made the Hall of Fame if they would have reached their potential. Ken Griffey Jr. did. So those are the three best young players I've ever seen.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Here's a talented young man, D.H. Jordan Alvarez, 1-for-2 tonight, an RBI single, visiting with Joe Morgan. The pitch to Alvarez. A strike, and the count evens at 1-1.
Have you seen this kid?
Yeah, but I've watched him because Enos Cabell and I talk all the time. He told me this kid is coming.
Oh, he's special.
He told me when they're coming. I don't know if I've ever seen him take an offer. I mean, he's just amazing. I mean, and he hits the ball hard. Watch his balance. He's got stuff that young guys don't have. I mean, he's got balance, and we see he has strength. But he can whip that bat through the zone, but he can wait, too. See, that's the difference. A lot of young guys come up and you start doing this to them.
Yeah.
They can't hit. This kid's not like that.
Joe was throwing a curveball, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hard radio. You were great on TV, by the way, for many, many years. I love watching
you.
The 1-2 pitch to Alvarez is outside ball two, 2-2. The eighth wonder of the world, the Astrodome. What in the world was it like when that ballpark opened?
When it opened, it was fantastic because it was so hot outside here. You couldn't play outside.
Oh, man, that had been awful.
But it was also very big.
Yes.
You know, you couldn't hit the ball out of the ballpark unless you were Jimmy Wynn. I mean, really.
Swing and a pop-up out of play on the left field side by Alvarez, 2-2 the count.
Dick Allen hit one center field, I think, the first regular season game.
Dick Allen could make it go, too, now. Yeah. I mean, you know, I had to tell you guys a little story. Straightaway right field was 390.
What?
Not right center, 390 straightaway.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had that 389-foot fly ball down to a tee. That's why this came in.
Oh, you got the flap?
It came in. Well, it was to remind me to get my elbow away from my body.
Here's a swing and a line shot into the gap in right center field by Alvarez. Ronnie second. Heading for third is Bregman. Up with the ball is Smith. The throw in is going to be cut off by the second baseman, Nola. Bregman will stop at third on a base hit, a single into right center by Jordan Alvarez. And now the Astros have runners on at first and third with one out. The kid can flat out hit.
I told you, I've watched him since he came up, and you're right, he can hit.
Rick brought up a point yesterday. He said he's wearing 44. Reminds him of Stretch. I said the style is a little bit different, but the presence is similar to McCovey and Stargell.
Well, he definitely has a presence.
Yes.
Every time he's hitting, I don't leave the room, as they say. I watch everything he does, and I've watched him. I don't think I've ever seen him go 0 for 4. Mm. I mean, he's a stud. I mean, he's hitting 320 or 330, whatever. Right.
Yeah, 336 coming into the game, and he's 2 for 3 tonight.
Yeah, he's their new stud. Yeah.
Here is Carlos Correa. Correa is 1 for 2 on the night. Astros lead it 4-0 on the home run by Altuve here in the bottom of the fifth inning. First and third for Houston with one out. The stretch and the pitch to Correa from Gonzalez spins him away from ball one. And you're here for many years in Houston, but what was it like on that big red machine? You had so much talent. Oh.
And so much fun. I mean, we talk about enjoying coming to the park every day. That was what the big red machine was about. Everybody on that team loved playing the game. They knew what their role was. And it was just an amazing clubhouse. It was just unbelievable to go in there sometimes. And, hey, we'd come to the ballpark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon just so we could hang out with each other. Yeah. You know, we played 8 o'clock games back in those
days.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember the 76 World Series, and the Yankees had a good team, and you guys mauled them. Mauled them.
76, people say 75 was the best team, but it wasn't. 75, we won more games regular season. But 76 was the best team. We swept the Phillies in the playoffs.
Yep.
We swept the Yankees. And if we'd had somebody else, we'd have swept them, too.
I don't think there's
any
question about it.
That's how good we were at that point. We had everybody was at the top of their game. We didn't have any injuries. Everything was just smooth, you know.
I mean, your bullpen was crazy good.
Everybody acts like we didn't have any pitching. But like you said, our bullpen was the best in the league. You know, we had Gary Nolan. We had Freddie Norman. We had Don Gullett, who was Jack Billingham. Those guys they could pitch, man.
Here's a swing and a foul back and out of play off to our right. Yeah. Almost to Joe Morgan, and the count is still even on Correa.
I would have gotten out of the way. That's the one thing I learned in the broadcast booth.
Yeah, buddy, that's exactly right.
When I was with John Miller, you didn't try to catch John. That hurts. The ball will hurt.
I know, it does.
I get out of the way. No, you can have it. I get it. If it stopped rolling back here, I'll pick it up.
There you go.
The old Euchre line, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm not definitely trying to catch any balls come up here.
Those days are done, man.
Marco Reddy and the 2-2 to Correa. Swing and a pop-up straight up above home plate. Off of the mask is Narvaez. Now he comes back to the warning track. Ooh. Quick adjustment. Reaches to his right, and he makes the catch. Correa pops it up. And Narvaez with enough room behind home plate to get to it. And there's two outs now for the Astros with two on here in the bottom of the fifth inning.
Give me, Joe, you talked about Jackie Robinson. I was wearing this 42 cap because, I mean, I said outside of my old man, probably my greatest hero for what he did and what he enabled you and I to do. What was your contact with him over the years?
I was fortunate enough. I only met him one time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was broadcasting Saturday afternoon baseball here in Pee Wee Reese. Mm-hmm. And they were going to do our game in San Francisco.
Here's the pitch to Gurriel. A swing and a pop-up down the right field line. Long run for Vogelbach and Nola, the second baseman, diving for the ball. And did he come up with it? No, he didn't. Just beyond the reach of Nola, diving behind Vogelbach down that right field line. Could not make the catch, but what an effort by Austin Nola. 0-1 on Gurriel.
Well, it'll let me finish my story, because if he'd have caught that.
Yeah.
Jackie Robinson was going to broadcast the game. I couldn't sleep the night before, knowing that he was going to broadcast our game. I couldn't wait to get to the stadium just to walk and say hi to him. All night I thought of things I was going to ask him. I'm going to ask him this. I'm going to ask him. I was all this stuff. I get to the park. And here he is. Man, I almost panicked. But I walked up to him, showed you how nervous I was. Only thing I could say to him was thank you.
Wow.
And he looked me in the
that
eye.
That said it all.
That's the best thing I've ever done, I tell people. I just said thank you. And he looked at me and he said, you're welcome. And he gave me that big smile.
Oh.
Wow.
And I said, if I'd have asked him all them dumb questions that I had, I'd have looked like an idiot. I said, that's the first time I got lucky by not saying anything.
That's all he wanted to hear.
Yeah, that's all he did. And that was enough. I just said thank you. And he smiled, and we shook hands, and that's the only time.
He was another guy that had presence, too, right?
Oh, please. Can you imagine?
Oh.
I'm
yeah.
Jackie Robinson, man. I'm waiting to see him.
Thank goodness it was Jackie, and Jackie did what he did when he did it.
Right. Well, you're right.
Open the doors.
You're
fouled
right.
out of play down the right field side by Gurriel. The count is now even at 2-2 strikes.
I think that's one of the things that bothers me about today's game.
Mm-hmm.
They have honored Jackie. They've done everything, but it's not for the – baseball honor him, it's for the players to honor him. I don't feel that the players understand who he was and what he did.
I agree with you.
I just don't think so.
We should know our history.
Yeah, I don't think they do. And it's unfortunate. Like I say, baseball does everything they can, you know, the 42 and the April 15th every year. But I don't think the players honor him because a lot of them didn't know anything about it.
Here's a swing and a foul back and out of play again. Still 2-2 on Gurriel.
You just made a good point. History, knowing your history of the game. Yeah, I knew my history, to be honest with you, not that everybody should be like me, but I love baseball so much I wanted to know all about it.
Sure.
I knew all about the Negro Leagues before I got to the big leagues.
There you go.
I wrote my college thesis on the Negro Leagues because I wanted to know who these guys were that came before me.
Buck O'Neill should be in the Hall of Fame.
Are you kidding
me? Why isn't Buck in the Hall of Fame? Swinging another ball back.
That's a crime.
He gets 17 people from the Negro Leagues in the Hall of Fame. There's a little statue of Buck in the Hall of Fame. He's not in the Hall of Fame. Played for the Monarchs, managed for the Monarchs, kept the history of the Negro Leagues alive.
It was at Lee Smith, Ernie Banks. Who else?
First African-American coach in the big leagues.
Look, I'm on the board of directors at the Hall of Fame. We couldn't believe when the vote came back.
Wow.
And it wasn't they could put any number they wanted. They had one shot at it. And they left Buck O'Neill off.
They went back in.
Yeah, they tried a couple of times. So what we did.
Swinging a pop up to Joe Morgan.
Yeah, right.
Right in front of Joe. Hey, Joe, you got to dive for that ball.
Well,
No.
We actually created the Buck O'Neill Award to try to honor him.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't in that group that was honored, you know, by going into the Hall of Fame.
I always say just on his appearance in Ken Burns' baseball alone, that was enough to put him in the Hall of Fame, let alone his work.
Swing and a ground ball to short. Backhanded by Crawford. All balance on the first. Low throw picked in time by Vogelback to get Gurriel, and that will retire the side. What a play by shortstop J.P. Crawford. Joe Morgan, thank you so much
for coming
by. Well,
that's a good time to leave on a big league play like
that. Right.
Awesome.
And that was a big league play.
Newest member.
Always a pleasure, guys. I listen to you all the time.
Great to see you, Joe.
Good to see you, man.
Okay, man.
Newest member of the Astros Hall of Fame. He's already in the Baseball Hall of Fame, Joe Morgan. We go to the top of the sixth inning. Astros lead it 4-0.
And finally, here's a really great conversation. Aaron Goldsmith with Al Kaline. And part of the conversation, he'll talk about the great World Series showdown between himself and Bob Gibson.
Mr. Kaline, you have been with the Tigers since June of 1953. I suppose there's a good reason why you were called Mr. Tiger. Your current role with the ball club, you are the special assistant to the president, Dave Dombrowski. Can you tell us a little bit about what your role is right now with the ball club?
Well, first of all, I was in the broadcast booth as an analyst with George Kell for 22 years, and then when my friend George Mike Gillies bought the ball club, he asked me if I would move into the front office and help him out and give my opinion on different situations. And then a short period after that, Dave Dombrowski joined the organization, and I've been working with Dave. And I sit in on all the meetings, major league meetings. Of course, I don't know everybody in the other minor leagues for other teams, so I can't really make any comments on those guys. But I sit in on the major league meetings about what our needs are, what we should do, and then I just give my opinion, and then they do what they want with it.
Your career is so vast, it's hard to even know exactly where to start. 22 years, of course, a Hall of Famer. I'd love to talk to you a little bit, Mr. Kaline, about your second full season in the major leagues. 1955, you're the youngest ever batting champion in the history of the game. You're only 20 years old. You hit 340. It was your first All-Star selection of 15 different times for the Midsummer Classic. Let's keep in mind, you're 20 years old at the time. The All-Star roster that year had the names of Nellie Fox, Ted Williams, Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra, Whitey Ford, Red Shane Dienst, Stan the Man Musial, a couple of heroes of yours, Willie Mays, Ernie Banks. You're a kid. What was it like for you at County Stadium for that first All-Star game?
I tell you what, I was so nervous sitting in that locker room with my favorite players. Of course, Ted Williams was one of my favorites, and Mantle was the star at that time in all of baseball. And I wish I were more of a veteran because I wanted to be able to go over and talk to him and maybe get some autographs, have my picture taken with him. But I was so shy and nervous that I just stayed away and just wanted to play the game is all.
It's pretty incredible when you think about where you were that young in your career, and especially when you consider the fact that you went straight from an 18-year-old high schooler to the major leagues, a bonus baby. How difficult was that for you to make that transition?
It was very hard. You know, I joined the team in Philadelphia, Philadelphia Athletics at the time, and it was very hard. I was not very welcomed by the players, obviously, because here's an 18-year-old kid out of high school, and I'm taking a veteran player's job. I had to stay in the big leagues for 2 years because I was a bonus player. I got $15,000 bonus. So I had to stay in the big leagues 2 years. But the players did not want anything to do with me. I was pretty much on my own. I had to find my way around. But the one thing I found out as soon as I put my uniform on, and I could shag balls and fly balls and catch the ball like anybody on our team at that time. I knew I could play the outfield. Now, hitting, different thing. 18-year-olds coming out of high school now facing major league pitchers. So that was something I really had to work on, and I did. But fortunately for me, I was always the guy that put the ball in play, even though it wasn't for power. Not too many guys just went right through me. I mean, I could put the ball in play, and even though it wasn't a hard hit ball all the time, but at least I didn't strike out all the time.
That's a good point. You bring up that All-Star season, that first one we were talking about. You had somewhere around 80 walks and only 50-some strikeouts, and you hit 340. You just don't see numbers like that anymore today. And yeah. I'm glad, Mr. Kaline, you brought up the outfield. 10 gold gloves, and people remember your powerful arm and, of course, your ability to cover the field as well. Where did that develop for you over the course of your career, before shagging fly balls maybe?
You know, I could always judge the ball, run the ball down, and always, for whatever reason, I always had a very strong, accurate arm. I may not have had the strongest arm, but I would put my name next to the most accurate thrower that I've ever seen. I always threw the ball. I never threw the ball that far off line like you see today sometimes, balls thrown 20, 30 feet off line. I never threw the ball that far. And every once in a while I might short hop the catcher or the third baseman and not give him a fair hop. But I was always very accurate, and I took very great pride in that. And that's something I don't think major league outfielders do today, take great pride in what they do in the outfield.
And which was more satisfying, maybe a late-inning home run or pegging a runner out at home plate from right field?
Well, they're both equally important. The one thing about making a good play that I might be helping a pitcher save his job. Hitting a home run, that's always great to have a walk-off home run. But I took pride in my outfield because I knew that pitcher out there was trying to fight for a job. And if I could help save a run or get out of an inning, it might help him stay in the big leagues.
I'd love to talk to you a little bit about 1968 and the World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals. It was an incredible World Series. It went 7 games, and the Cardinals really had the upper hand early in that series. They won 3 of the first 4, and the margin of victory was pretty extreme, it seems like, for each one of those Redbird wins. But bottom of the 7th, Game 5, you're at the plate. Tigers are down by a run, a 2-run single from you, which gives the Tigers the lead. The Tigers would go on to win Game 6, and, of course, win Game 7 to win the World Series. Can you take us back to inside the batter's box, what that moment was like for you?
Yeah, well, it was great. I was very happy to be the guy up at the plate because I never was afraid to fail. I always wanted the opportunity. And if I failed, it wasn't because I wasn't trying, but I just wanted the opportunity. And I was in there against Joe Horner, who was a left-handed pitcher, and I knew all about him. I knew that his best pitch was turning the ball over, keeping the ball down and away from a right-hander. And even though it would have been nice to be able to hit a home run, but I knew that my best chance was the base hit up the middle, driving a run. And that's what I tried to do. I anticipated that he was going to try to get me out with his best pitch. And so I looked for his best pitch and was able to get a base hit to right center field to drive in a run. And fortunately for us, we got ahead there, and we stayed ahead from there on out.
So now that we've established all this and the fact that you hit nearly 380 in those 7 games in the World Series, a couple of home runs, 8 RBIs, can we talk about Game 1?
Yeah, sure.
Bob Gibson turned in an absolutely historic performance. 5 hits. You had one of them, a complete game shutout from another Hall of Famer, and a World Series record, 17 strikeouts in an absolutely dominating performance. What do you remember about Bob Gibson in game one of the 1968 World Series?
He's the toughest SOB I've ever faced. That's what I'm going to remember about it. But he was just on a dynamite, and I'm glad I didn't have to face him for very much in my career, because he was just one of the great guys. He was a mean son of a gun on the mound. He wasn't afraid to brush you back. But for that game, I mean, it was just wonderful, even though he beat us, to see somebody with that much talent and that much desire to be great, he absolutely was. So, I've got to be very good friends with Bob now that we're in the Hall of Fame, and I always keep saying that, Bob, how come you're always so mean on the mound? You want to knock guys down? He says, well, you know, I don't mind them hitting balls when I throw a pitch inside, but when they lean out over the plate and hit that ball low outside and hits one, that makes me mad, and the next time I face them, I always knock them down.
Was Bob Gibson the most intimidating pitcher that you faced in your 22-year career?
I would say he's up there pretty close to it. I would say he was very intimidating. But Bob always says that, you know, he said, everybody says, I'm staring at him all the time. He said, they didn't realize I couldn't see the signs. So I was staring at the catcher with a mean growl on my face, but I couldn't see the signs from the catcher, and the hitters all thought I was staring at them.
That's incredible. We would never know that. Your 3,000th hit came in your hometown of Baltimore, a double into the corner in right field. What was that moment like for you when you rounded into second base, you stood up, and your parents were there at the ball game, and what was that moment like?
Well, it was great. You know, I had asked our general manager if they wanted me to wait to get it in Detroit. And they said, no, you go out and get it whenever you can, because of Roberto Clemente had, got his last one. And unfortunately, he got a terrible accident and was killed. So the next best thing was in Baltimore, my hometown. I had certainly my mom and dad and some family members there, and a lot of my high school buddies and stuff were all at the games to watch the game. So if we have a little bit of time, I'll tell you a little story about Dave McNally, who was the pitcher I got the base hit off of. Dave called me in spring training and says, Al, he says that my brother and I are trying to get a Ford dealership in Idaho, someplace where he lived in the off season. Do I know Lee Iacocca? I said, yeah, Lee's a very good friend of mine. He says, we're trying to get a Ford dealership. So anyhow, I called Mr. Iacocca, and I said, Dave McNally. He says, okay, I'll have somebody call Dave. And make a long story short, they were able to get the Ford dealership in the next little town. So Dave calls me. Once the season started, he says, Al, he says, I want to thank you for getting the Ford dealership. And I dreamt that you got your 3,000th hit off of me. Sure enough, in September, I got my base hit off of Dave McNally, who I wore out anyhow because he was left-handed, and I got a double down the right field line.
That's incredible. Do you remember what your first conversation was like with him once it happened? Because that's amazing that he had the premonition that it would happen that way.
No, I never talked to him after that. I mean, he just had called me on the phone and thanked me for helping get the Ford dealership, and that he dreamt that I would get the base hit off of him. And I had forgot all about it. And then once I got over to the locker room after the game, he called me and says, I told you were going to. So anyhow, it was very nice of him, yeah.
Now, going back to an earlier comment, that was awfully thoughtful of you to ask the Tigers if they wanted you to wait. Had they had said yes, that they wanted you to wait till the Tigers got back home, do you have any idea what you would have done in the batter's box for however many more at-bats he would have had sitting on 2,099 hits?
Yeah, you know, it was at least four or five games before we would have gotten back to Detroit for a chance to get the 3,000 hit. But, again, I don't know what I would have done. I wouldn't have gone to the plate and tried to make it out, because there was only one time I was glad to ever make it out in my life, and that was the first time I was called a pinch hit when I was 18 years old. First game in the major leagues, and Freddie Hutchinson, our manager, didn't even know my name. He says, hey, kid, grab a bat. It was the eighth inning, and, of course, I didn't have a bat. It was much too heavy for me, and I pinched it and hit the first pitch to center field for an out, and I was the only time I was ever happy to make an out.
Well, we'll wrap up from going from your first ever major league at-bat to 1980 in Cooperstown, New York, when you're inducted into the Hall of Fame. And two of the first names that you mentioned in your speech were two players that you called inspirations to you to want to be a major leaguer, Ted Williams and Stan the Man Musial. Can you tell us what it was about each one of those players growing up that you admired so much?
Well, Stan Musial was always my all-time, all-around favorite player because he was sort of a guy I try to model myself after, hitting the ball to all fields, able to run a little bit. And of course, Ted was always considered the greatest hitter of all time, and everybody would try to emulate, be a hitter like Ted Williams. I got to be very friendly with Ted Williams. He liked me a lot, and we've had great conversations during our careers and while he was alive. But they were two guys that I idolized. I really loved Ted Williams not only for his baseball skills, but for the type of man he was on and off the field. He was really my all-time idol.
So you talk about both those players, and as we talked about earlier, they're in the first All-Star game you appear in. Of course, Williams is on the same side as you in the same clubhouse. Stan Musial is on the National League side. Did you say anything to Stan Musial or to Ted Williams in that first All-Star game?
I don't remember saying anything to anybody, to be honest with you. I was too nervous, but I was on. I was a leading vote getter that year because I was leading the league. And I played the whole game, and Stan Musial hit a home run in the extra innings to beat us in Milwaukee. So I remember that part of it. And if you ever see the highlights of Stan Musial hitting a home run, I'm that little outfielder going to the fence when the ball's over. I wish that, like I said, I wish I was a more of a veteran, experienced guy. But being just 20 years old and being in an All-Star game with all these great, great, great players, I wish I'd have had been able to say more and talked a little bit. But I was always thought if you're young and a rookie, sort of like a rookie, keep your mouth shut and go play baseball.
Mr. Kaline, this has been an absolutely incredible experience. Thank you so much for all the time and all the tremendous stories. This has been a real honor. Thank you so much.
Oh, this is great. Thanks for asking me. And I've been blessed to be not only a fairly good baseball player, but be in this great game for a long time.